Hello, rock and rollers. It's that time again as your reader, Dennis Pratt, takes you behind
the cover of the Rolling Stone. Rolling Stone.
Wanna see my picture on the cover?
Stone.
Wanna buy 5 copies for my mother?
Yeah!
Stone. Wanna see my smiling face
on the cover of the Rolling Stone.
Today I will continue reading from the August 2019 issue of Rolling Stone that featured on its cover Billie Eilish. And of course I read that article last week. So this week we'll turn ahead a couple pages and we'll do a look at a profile. Tanya Tucker, The Return of a Country Hellraiser. After some serious battles, the outlaw returns for a soulful comeback LP. And before we read the rest of this article, why don't we listen to what that LP may sound like.
I spring my flowers now while I'm living.
Bring my flowers now while I'm living. I won't need your love when I'm gone. Don't spend time, tears, and money.
Tanya Tucker walks into a bar, or my office, as she calls it. The 60-year-old singer who shot to fame with the gospel stomper Delta Dawn in 1972 at age 13 is unmistakable with a neon pink hairdo as she holds court for the next 2 hours at one of her favorite spots in Nashville. She reflects on everything from the time Elvis tried to kiss her. My father said he can have any girl he wants, but he can't have you. To current country phenom Mason Ramsey. He's a yodeler. Better have another gig, too. The conversation is interrupted after Tucker finishes her second dirty martini and spies Miranda Lambert leaving. Tucker hustles out to pitch her a song written by her oldest daughter, Presley. Tucker is feeling extra motivated to score a hit lately, now that she's back in the music game. She just completed While I'm Living, her first album in 10 years, produced by Brandi Carlile and Shooter Jennings, which sets Tucker's tough country tenor against spare Americana arrangements. Carlile hopes it revives her legacy. She hasn't been given the respect she deserves, says Carlile, as she fell on hard times. I don't think she was given the same grace an artist like Waylon and Willie and Cash were given for their times that they didn't live up to their own standards. She should be lauded the same way so many of these amazing outlaw men are. Tucker has been known as a hellraiser for most of her life. She became a teen star with the support of her dad manager, Bo, scoring 13 top 10 country hits in the 1970s. By the age 22, Tucker was a tabloid fixture for dating Glenn Campbell, who was twice her age. If we'd met later, when I realized what kind of love we had, we'd probably have died together, she says. She got hooked on cocaine and entered rehab in 1988. After 2009, Tucker stopped releasing music, instead traveling the country with her daughter, Layla. For a while, there it felt like no one gave a darn, Tucker says. She was initially reluctant to record again, even after Carlile approached her with songs she had written with her bandmates, with a plan to produce alongside Jennings. Just days before sessions were to begin in L.A., Tucker pulled out of the project, she said. Shooter, I don't think these songs are right for me. But he talked her into it, and soon she was belting heartbreaking tunes like Bring My Flowers Now, where Tucker says she wished she was a better daughter to her mother who died in 2012. Bring My Flowers Now while I'm living, she sings. Tucker is hesitant to describe while I'm living as a comeback, my least favorite word, she says. But she can't help but get sentimental when presented with her first Rolling Stone cover from 1974 with the cover line, I'm Tanya Tucker, and I'm 15, you're gonna hear from me. It should be 40 years later, I'm Tanya Tucker, she says, and you're still hearing from my ass. Time now for an article about Dr. John, the joy and mystery of a New Orleans saint. Robbie Robertson has seen a lot in six decades of rock and roll, but nothing quite like what happened at the Toronto Pop Festival in 1969. He and the band were on a bill that included the New Orleans studio musician and songwriter Mac Rebennack, newly reinvented as Dr. John, the Night Tripper. This guy I'm talking to, he has strands of beads and stuff coming off his head, and powders coming out of his ears and rags hanging down, recalls Robertson. He's got a walking stick that looks like something you perform magic tricks with. When rain began to pour down on the grounds, Robertson watched as Dr. John, playing an incantatory style of swamp pop dubbed voodoo rock by a baffled media, raised the stick to the sky and held it for a moment. Just then, the rain stopped. As Robertson remembers, we're like, man, the doctor is really a doctor. Dr. John was always modest about his place in the history of New Orleans music. Everything I'm about, the old-timers showed me, he once said. Nothing I got is nothing original. He'd be the first to admit that he picked up his spry, Rolling River piano playing from predecessors like Longhair, Fats Domino, and Huey Piano Smith. But few embodied the spirit of New Orleans or helped take it to strange new places the way Dr. John did, even though he scored just one pot hit, 1973's Right Place, Wrong Time. His impact on modern music was huge, beginning with Murky Swamplands masterpieces like 1968's Gree Gree and 1972's Dr. John's Gumbo, a tribute to New Orleans that helped introduce rock fans to standards like Ico Ico. 80s kids know him from his theme song to the sitcom Blossom. Gen Z recognizes his voice from animated films like The Princess and the Frog. And anyone who remembers The Muppet Show knows the dapper bandleader Dr. Teeth, modeled on Dr. John. He wasn't just New Orleans, he was worldwide, says Aaron Neville, who met Dr. John when both were teenagers. He brought New Orleans everywhere. And with Dr. John's death near New Orleans at age 77 on June 6th of a heart attack, rock lost one of the last links to its Wild West days. He witnessed the grimy, gangster-ridden underbelly of early rock and roll, coming away with a heroin habit, a prison sentence, and half a finger blown off in the process. His surly tomcat rasp conjured the Southern Chitlin' Circuit and funky bars, where R&B and rock were birthed. He was a human melting pot, growing up with different races and experiences, says the Black Keys' Dan Auerbach, who produced Dr. John's 2012 comeback album, the Grammy-winning Locked Down, and it made him the most incredible mutt ever. From Bob Dylan to Lana Del Rey, musicians have regularly wiped their slates clean, but few did it with as much style as Rubinek did when he became Dr. John in the late 1960s. He always carried himself with a sense of mystery, addressing the world through witty pronouncements from behind his molasses-thick swamp rat drawl. Where did Mac Rubinek end and Dr. John begin? As he would say in one of his unique phrasings, "I got some confusement here." Malcolm Rubinek Jr. wasn't necessarily destined to become Dr. John. As a baby in New Orleans, Third Ward, a middle-class neighborhood, Mac was so adorable that he was featured in an Ivory soap ad. Harry Connick Jr. had a relative who lived next to the Rubineks, and in light of Dr. John's mangy image, was surprised to find out how conventional young Mac's house was. "It's in a pretty nice part of town," Connick says. "It was hard for me to imagine that neighborhood would be his." Yet the late-night side of town proved irresistible to Rubinek. His father owned an appliance store that carried records. What his son later called gospel, bebop, real filthy party records, and hillbilly stuff like Hank Williams, and repaired sound systems at local venues. Tagging along with his dad on club visits, Mac glimpsed legends like Professor Longhair. His aunt gave him piano lessons as a kid, but he soon switched to guitar. "New Orleans produced a lot of good piano players and some good drummers," he said, "but for some reason there weren't a lot of guitar players around, so I kind of filled the need." By his teen years, he was playing sessions and writing songs for local acts. "We called him the Ratty Dude," says Neville, who sang on an early Rubinek session. "He was hip. Instead of, 'How you doing?' he'd say, 'Where you at?' He was a bad dude on guitar." In 1961, Dr. John was on the road with soul singer Ronnie Barron when a motel manager pulled a gun on Barron, who may have been sleeping with the man's old lady. Rubinek reached for his weapon, and it went off, leaving part of his left finger hanging by a thread. As he wrote in his 1995 memoir, Under a Hoodoo Moon, the shooting was a pivotal moment in Dr. John's life, forcing him to switch to bass and then piano. But the injury also accelerated a heroin habit that had already begun. "At that moment I was shot, I saw not just my life, but my career pass before my eyes," he wrote. "To get through it all, I tried to make myself as null and void as possible, a state I achieved through a heightened habit." Busted for possession, he wound up serving time in a federal prison. According to Neville's brother, Charles, during an early prison stint, Dr. John became known as the Zuzu Man, selling cigarettes and sweets. Upon his release in 1965, he wound up in L.A., home to many relocated New Orleans musicians. He would long blame District Attorney Jim Garrison, played by Kevin Costner in JFK, for clamping down on New Orleans nightclubs and depriving local musicians of steady work. He became a sessions player for Sonny and Cher, Buffalo Springfield, and other pop acts, but he also wanted to make his own music. With other New Orleans transplants, he recorded his first album, Gree Gree, in 1967. It was named after the term for the charms, amulets, and incantations used by voodoo believers that were meant to fend off evil, as shadowy and murky as the swamps, Gree Gree. And its centerpiece, 8 minutes of eerie lurking chants called I Walk on Gilded Splinters, embodied the way Dr. John took his hometown's musical heritage to new outer space dimensions. Dr. John mixed in funk, psychedelia, field hollers, Latin rhythms and rock and roll, a template that he would continue for decades. While working on the album, Dr. John came up with a plan for his live shows that would transport Mardi Gras to the stage. Working with producers Harold Baptiste, he concocted the idea of a Dr. John named after a 19th century Louisiana voodoo priest and jack of all mystical trades. "I was just trying to hustle album deals, just trying to hustle money," he said in 1997. The Dr. John thing was just a concept, a one-of thing. Barron was supposed to play the character on stage, but when he declined, Rebenack donned the headdresses, feathers, and beads himself. "Nobody else could have done it like he did," says Neville. "He brought it to life." How authentic was the character? "I don't believe Mac had nothing to do with no voodoo," says Neville. "It was all part of his shtick. He had a good heart." Dr. John himself demurred as to whether he was an actual voodoo practitioner or not. "I don't have voodoo dolls or anything like that," he said at the time. "There's a lot of the Mardi Gras spirit in many areas of show business," he said. "It's always been my feeling that when someone goes to see a show, they should get all their senses pleased." Yet his fascination with hoodoo rituals was also sincere. Dr. John once said his grandmother, in some sort of trance, had lifted a heavy wooden table in their home. He was baptized Catholic, but as a teen, he sometimes played at the Guiding Star Spiritual Church, which welcomed Christians, Jews, and voodoo practitioners. "I dug the spiritual and the hoodoo church people because their bag wasn't like organized religion," he said. To cast a spell on anyone he didn't want around, Dr. John would make goofer dust, a combination of graveyard dirt, gunpowder, and grease from the bells of a graveyard chapel. He believed in voodoo rituals. "It was not a shtick," says Bill Bentley, one of his publicists. "He had all these herbs he would carry around with him. He once said this lady put a spell on him and something bad happened to him." When Dr. John visited the band before the 1971 New York shows that resulted in their Book of Ages album, he saw they were nervous and sprinkled mystery powder around a hotel room. He said, "It's going to be okay now," says Robertson. He was always spreading his juju wherever it was necessary. With Right Place, Wrong Time, Dr. John brought his Grigri funk to the top 40. But the Night Tripper persona moved and proved too expensive and controversial to maintain, and he soon replaced it with a more urban style in wardrobe, embodied by his appearance at the band's Last Waltz show in 1976, when the Doctor played Such a Night. "That song was the feeling of the evening," says Robertson. "His presence was so warm and beautiful, and that performance projected that as much as anything that happened the whole night." By then, Dr. John had relocated to New York, where he befriended Doc Pomus, the wheelchair-bound tunesmith who had co-written Save the Last Dance for Me and an array of classic 60s hits. The two quickly became friends and collaborators. "It blew my dad's mind that Mac knew so many of the songs my dad wrote," says Sharon Felder, Pomus's daughter. "He said he never felt as musically connected to anyone since the early days as he did with Mac." The two would huddle in the bedroom of Pomus's Upper West Side apartment, drinking root beer and cranking out songs, including "There Must Be a Better World Somewhere," which B.B. King covered. But Dr. John remained a heroin user and often shot up in the family bathroom. Girlfriends and ex-wives, he was married three times, most recently to songwriter Cat Yellen, and had six children. He would call Palmas to ask where his songwriter partner was. "Don't tell him I'm here," Dr. John would tell Palmas. "My dad loved Mac as much as he loved his own, but he would drive him crazy," says Felder. "He was always worried about Mac and would get angry and upset at him." After his commercial heyday, Dr. John survived by touring, singing jingles for Popeye's Chicken, and appearing on soundtracks. He released solo piano albums that revisited the ballroom style of his youth, and in the 1980s, he helped pioneer the concept of rock stars playing pre-rock standards in a sentimental mood. Along the way, he developed a casual fatalism about the music business. "I've seen the record business from a lot of ways, and don't nothing surprise me anymore," he said in 1997. "I've been dropped by a lot of labels, and the only thing that surprises me is that they don't drop me sooner." Around 1989, he finally cleaned up, checking into rehab for his drug abuse. At Palmas' funeral in 1991, Dr. John played organ and gave a eulogy referring to himself as a guy who used to be a scumbag dope fiend. He was saved by Palmas, recalls Robertson. "Years later, when I would see him, I'd remind him of one of these stories, and he would say, 'Oh yeah, man, I try to put that stuff behind me.'" Disaster brought him back home. Newly clean, Dr. John began recording and touring regularly and attending recovery meetings in New York. But after Hurricane Katrina, he found a new mission. His 2008 album, City That Care Forgot, expressed his anger over the neglect of New Orleans. Soon after, he moved back to his native city. He wanted to see this city rebuilt and people come back to New Orleans, says his daughter, Carla Pratt. He played a charity concert for displaced musicians in the Ninth Ward. Later, he personally went to Walgreens to buy medications the musicians required. In 2010, Auerbach felt the time had come for Dr. John to return to the mood of his swamp rock work. After tracking down his phone number, Auerbach called but could barely decipher anything thanks to Dr. John's smokescreen, extra-thick accent. "I found out later that this was his defense mechanism for strangers," says Auerbach. He'd been ripped off by so many different people over the years. Getting his address, Auerbach flew to New Orleans and showed up unannounced at a duplex Dr. John shared with his newly released ex-con friend. When Dr. John opened the door, Auerbach recalls, he looked incredible. He was dressed in a Guayabera shirt and wearing full beads, hair perfectly braided, not necessarily a stage costume, but the most incredible thing you ever seen. Dr. John agreed to make the album, although trombonist and producer Cyril Morrow, one of Dr. John's collaborators, recalls some initial anxiety. "He really liked Dan, but I remember Mac calling me, and he was very uncomfortable, she says. "He was being pushed out of his comfort territory, but what Dan did for him was amazing. That album was a modern-day Grigri." Release in 2012, lockdown came in the middle of a comeback for Dr. John. He had just been inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, and the album took home the Grammy for the Best Blues Album, which Auerbach recalls meant the world to him, a validation. Those who got to know the real man could understand why. Mac was surprisingly insecure for someone who was this icon and beloved by so many, says Morrow. "Even if you're sober for years, you still have guilt or doubt you carry around with you. He didn't think he really deserved the fame, the wealth, or whatever it is that he could have had. He remained tied to this city and its traditions in other ways. He still dined occasionally on local delicacies like possum and raccoon. During walks, he'd pick up only certain colored leaves for some type of home altar. Another friend, local bassist Jim Benito, looked on as Dr. John boiled a squirrel, removed the bones, and affixed them to one of his canes. At various times, one or another of his walking sticks would include a yak bone and a pouch made from a kangaroo's scrotum. When a Twitter account was set up for him a decade ago, he announced an idea for a post with, "I got a Twizzler for the computer machine." Characters were CAR-actors. Even his textiles, parentheses text, no spaces between words, captured his swamp frog elocution. "I hope someone does a glossary of his language," says Bonnie Raitt, a friend since the 1970s. There was no possibility of autocorrect ever. But as he entered his 70s, health issues began to overtake him. Due to cirrhosis of the liver, he could no longer eat his beloved New Orleans shellfish. He began spending more time with his kids, splitting time between his son's house on Lake Pontchartrain and daughter Carla's house in New Orleans. Carla would watch her father crack up watching reruns of The Carol Burnett Show. He loved Tim Conway and Harvey Korman, she says. He would laugh until tears were falling down his face. He continued performing despite increased physical discomfort. He had this outward appearance of being old and slow, but man, you could talk about eagle eyes, says bassist Roland Guerin, his last musical director. He knew exactly what everybody was doing. Starting around 2017, he began making what would be his last album, recording country covers and remakes of older songs like Such a Night. Neville appeared on a cover of the Traveling Wilburys' End of the Line, a jolly song about accepting one's life and fate. "Mac liked it," says Neville. "He knew he was on the way out, and he was at peace with it," Carla begs to differ. "I do not believe he knew he was about to die. He was looking forward to getting out there and getting back to his old routine. He never gave up." Last year, Dr. John was diagnosed with aphasia, a condition that impedes speaking. He eventually received speech therapy and moved into a rehabilitation center. On June 2nd, he was visited there by John Cleary, a British musician who toured with him. Cleary brought along a portable record player, and the two listened to records from Dr. John's youth, like New Orleans singer-guitarist Smiley Lewis. Dr. John held Cleary's hand, and despite his inability to speak, sang along as best he could. After Dr. John's death, 4 days later, New Orleans gave him a traditional second-line funeral, with revelers and brass band snaking through the city of his birth. Transported through the streets by a horse-drawn carriage, his casket was trailed by mourners, including one holding a poster with dual photos, one of the young Night Tripper, the other an older, more dapper version. Right to the end, the devilish and the debonair were always one and the same. And right to the end of this show we are now. So please join me next week at the same time as we once again go behind.
Cover of the Rolling Stone. On the cover of the Rolling Stone.
Yeah, see my picture.
I don't know why we ain't on the cover, baby. We're beautiful fellas. I ain't kidding you. Oh, we would make a beautiful cover. A fresh shot.
Right up front, man. I can see it now.
We'd be on the front smiling, man. Oh, beautiful.